Welcome to A Gram of Hope. I'm your host, C. Jerome Graham. Today, we're going to be talking to Tony Dybul. This is a man that's everything opioid. If you want to know what's going on, what the current news is, what the current history is, what programming is out there, Tony Dybul is the man to contact. How you doing, Tony?
I'm doing well. How are you, Jerome?
Man, I'm glad to have you on this whatever day time this is.
Yeah.
Want to talk about the Chalk Walk, because that's an ongoing program from the health department. Now, you're the opioid coordinator, and we'll get to the Chalk Walk in a minute, but what does an opioid coordinator do?
Yeah, sure. So, I work for the Toledo Lucas County Health Department. I'm the overdose prevention coordinator. You know, you could also say opioid coordinator. But really, a lot of our efforts and a lot of my efforts in my role is to serve as kind of like a community liaison, work with different sectors to address the overdose epidemic that we're seeing. You know, at the health department, we have multiple programs. We have a naloxone coordinator. We have our harm reduction program. We have my role where I work, honestly, on a regional grant right now where we're working with Northwest Ohio and 19 counties in Northwest Ohio, really just to bolster overdose prevention efforts. And that can look very different from place to place. It could be reducing stigma. It can be raising awareness around the dangers that exist today. And then also just building those resources, such as naloxone access, which is a life-saving medication to reverse an overdose. But also really just connecting people that work closely with those suffering so that, you know, we can better link people to care. But in a nutshell, it's a little bit of all of those things. And it's certainly, you know, has its rough days, and it can be tough because I think recent estimates, we've seen some reductions in overdose deaths, but for many years, especially post-COVID, we were seeing over 100,000 deaths due to an overdose in this country per year. And even the CDC has estimated that if you're between the age of 18 and 45 in this country, the leading cause of death is an accidental overdose. And I think a lot of us talk about many of us are impacted or we're all touched in some way by addiction. But, you know, I don't think people truly sometimes grasp the lives that are being lost. So a lot of this work is around trying to, you know, combat that.
Is it a challenge for your department? And I'm glad you worded it as overdose prevention. Is it a challenge for you because opioids are legal? Does that make it any more difficult?
I think what can be difficult is that, you know, especially when we're thinking of prescription opioids, there are people who deal with chronic pain, and we aren't here to say, you know, people shouldn't have access to opioids because that can be quality of life for someone. What we are really focused on is, you know, what are the consequences of past, even just big pharma actions such as OxyContin, Purdue Pharma. You know, we consume, I don't know the exact statistic, but we consume something like 70% of the world's opioids in this country. It's just the way we treat pain. We treat pain very differently. And with that demand and with that dependence on these drugs, especially as prescriptions have been cracked down on because of some of the actions of big pharma, we've seen the drug supply changing. And so really in our work, we're looking at the street drug supply. And a lot of that is synthetic opioids now. So that would be like fentanyl. There's many different analogs that we see, but, you know, that's really what's been driving death is fentanyl and synthetic opioids. There's even newer ones entering the supply that we see, and we see really the drug supply consistently changing, but the one common theme has been synthetic drugs. And I think a lot of people don't even realize anymore if they're buying a drug on the street, they don't know what they're getting. Which can be concerning. So, I mean, I'm happy to talk more about just like what that looks like, if you'd like,
sure.
As far as,
you know, because I hear people talk about using opioids, the legal ones, the prescription one. When you go to the doctor, I not too long ago went to the doctor. I had an issue with my stomach, and lo and behold, they gave me oxycodone, and I said, "Isn't this supposed to be addictive?" I just got a little stomach ache. I don't know if I'm supposed to take this. And they said, no, as long as you take it as prescribed, you'll be all right. I think I took two of them, and I still have the rest sitting someplace, but I'm just a little bit leery. But what does that look like?
Yeah, well, and even in the situation you're talking about, many people who do develop a substance use disorder or, you know, an addiction that really truly changes their life, they oftentimes do start with prescription medications and, you know, oftentimes don't realize if they don't take it responsibly or if they're on it long term, you know, what those side effects can be. But that's not to say that they don't play a role, because we know, obviously, you know, people don't have to be in pain. It's just trying to strike that balance. And in the work that we do, we see a lot of folks who are struggling starting with a prescription. It's not just people waking up one day and saying, you know, I want to try heroin, for instance, or something like that. Oftentimes it starts, and we know what the risk factors are. That could be, you know, stress and trauma in your life. That's why I think COVID, we saw numbers skyrocket even more because people were disconnected from those connections. But, you know, even just things like your genetics can play a huge role. If there's substance use or addictive personalities in the family, that can really impact someone's risk. Like I said, stress and trauma, but also, you know, the environment you're in, how early you're experimenting or using these substances. You know, if the younger someone tries, whether it's an opioid or even just marijuana or drinking, the younger they are, the more likely they are to develop a risk or a substance use disorder and be at risk. So it's really kind of taking that all into account and then trying to communicate that information through prevention on different levels, really. But specific to like expanding on the drug supply, nowadays, yes, there are people that get prescriptions, but, you know, we even see people in our fatality reviews who are maybe passing away from, they have a prescription for oxycodone, they run out, neighbor down the street who they trust, it's a community, maybe sells what they think is oxycodone, and the person selling the drugs oftentimes doesn't even realize it's a fake pressed pill, and it may have contamination and have fentanyl or something else in it. And we've seen fatalities arise from that. And I think that's kind of the bigger picture is now, especially if you're buying anything on the street, even the dealers don't know what they have sometimes because it's touching 10, 15 hands before it gets to them. But there's fake pressed pills that look so much like the real thing. It could be a Xanax or an Adderall or an oxycodone, or, you know, it could look very, very real, even for someone who's been prescribed that drug before, and really it's a fake press pill. But also, you know, drugs like cocaine, you know, some people party once in a while and may drink on the weekends and do cocaine here and there, and that could be contaminated. So we really like to focus on the fact that anything could have it in it. It's not that we're saying, you know, don't, everything has fentanyl in it, because that's not true, but it's that you're always at risk, like you just never know. And that has to be the message we pass to the public. And you know, I think especially we're seeing it now too, like disproportionately impacting minority populations like the Hispanic and African American communities. And I think a lot of that is because, you know, the drug supply is so volatile compared to even 10, 15 years ago. You know, I think oftentimes people knew what they were at least getting back then. And it's right. Not to say drugs are safe, but, you know, this work isn't about, as long as humans have existed, people have used substances, and our mission can never be like, hey, we're going to stop people from ever using drugs or escaping their pain, because we all do it in some way, shape, or form, whether it's drugs or something else that we seek comfort from. But now we want people to be aware of the dangers and also educate them that there are tools that can help you be safe if you are going to use substances. And I'm happy to talk more about that as well. But, you know, that's just kind of plays into the bigger picture.
That's going to segue into where I wanted to go with another characteristic of the drug, because you indicated that some of the pills are pressed and you may not know what is pressed in them. One of the exciting things, I would say, for lack of a better term, now are gummies. Everything is a gummy now. Has there been any research about opioids hitting the streets or fentanyl hitting the streets as a gummy product?
You know, anecdotally, I think I've seen stories of that. You know, I think you're in a lot of ways, that's like with the legalization of marijuana, it's a very hot topic. And, you know, I think there's more of uncertainty around what could be going into gummies. But, you know, I don't think we've seen a necessarily specific case locally, but we just try to educate on like following the same guidelines of like, if you are going to use substances, be safe, you know, never use drugs alone. Always try to be responsible. If you are going to use drugs, carry naloxone. You know, it's accessible. You can get it for free through the health department. Everyone can carry it. It's very easy to use. And that's a tool you can have if the worst happened and you unknowingly ingested fentanyl, or if you knew you were, you know, this is for even people who may know that they're using something that could have fentanyl in it. You know, at least you have the life-saving medication on hand. You're not alone. And we also, it's been legalized or decriminalized, I should say, through Governor DeWine in Ohio, but now there's fentanyl testing strips where if someone does want to test the product that they're using or test the drugs they're using, you can use a test strip. And it's really just like you dip it, like almost like a pregnancy test. You dip it in water. If someone's getting a pill, they could break off a piece of the pill, mix it with a little water, dip it in there and see, okay, you know, there's fentanyl in my drug or not. It's not going to tell you how much fentanyl's in it or not, and it's not going to tell you what kind of analog it is, which is getting into the weeds, but there are more potent versions of fentanyl, so it's not going to tell you the nitty-gritty, but it's at least going to give you that awareness. And, you know, for us, like, I know I remember seeing some college students a few years back on the news had passed away. I think it was like 3 or 4 of them, thinking that they were studying for a test. They got Adderall from someone. They took the Adderall. They were going to stay up all night, study for a test, and it was a fake pressed Adderall. It had fentanyl in it, and, you know, they passed away. And that could have been avoidable. Obviously, we don't want to encourage people to do that, but at the same time, if they maybe had a fentanyl test strip, they could have at least been like, all right, I know this doesn't have fentanyl in it. Or if they knew it had fentanyl in it, they could have carried naloxone and been very much more responsible about the way they used. And I think that that's a lot of the education we try to bring out. And it's really not meant to be fear factor or fear tactics. It's really truly
should be.
You know, it is scary, but, you know, we just want this to be a more normalized conversation. And especially if you are struggling, we don't want people to feel like they can't reach out for support or, you know, talk to someone, because it's so much more common and we all truly struggle with something, whether, you know, it's substances or it could be food or it could be, you know, sex or it could be other things. Like, we all have a vice and we all struggle with something. So the more we can be open and comfortable talking about that, I think the better.
Now, carfentanil is the most dangerous fentanyl, isn't it? Or is there, or does it make any difference? Fentanyl is fentanyl.
There is a difference, and that kind of goes into that analog speak. And you're right, carfentanil is very, very potent, and that's going to be many, many times more potent than regular fentanyl. And fentanyl is 100 times more potent than morphine. So, like, we're going way up the food chain. Carfentanil is actually used to, like, sedate oftentimes large game
in
zoos. Yeah, like elephants. So it's a very, very powerful opioid. The good news is we do not see, we don't see that very often, but it has popped up here and there. And I think it's just another reason to be very careful and to be very aware of what you're doing. And, you know, that would, like, for instance, carfentanil would test positive on a fentanyl test strip, but you wouldn't know it's carfentanyl. It would just say, your strip would say it's positive. So there's no way to know if it's the analog that's a lesser potent form of fentanyl or if it is carfentanil, which is, you know, many, many times more potent. But that's something that's kind of popped up, and I think it was a big news story maybe 5-6 years ago. I think Cincinnati had some carfentanil spikes, but these are just all things we monitor too, because nowadays we're seeing even newer things enter the supply, like xylazine is one, and that's often being mixed with opioids. So xylazine is like a veterinary sedative. So it's actually not an opioid, which means it wouldn't respond to naloxone, because naloxone only works on opioids. Xylazine can have many complications. You know, people aren't waking up now when they may overdose, and it may be fentanyl mixed with xylazine, and that may reverse the opioid overdose, but it doesn't do anything for the sedative, which creates problems for our first responders. It can have really bad impacts on people's bodies, creating like flesh infections and, you know, things of that nature. We're also seeing new synthetic opioids called like nitazenes in the drug supply nationally and a little bit locally. We don't have the hard data locally, but we hear anecdotally from people we work with that, like, yes, it's it's in the drug supply. Metatomidine's a new one. So as you can tell, it's a lot of synthetic drugs, and it's ever-changing, ever-evolving. So, you know, our best first defense still is things like naloxone and educating the public. But as always, the drugs of choice and what even is being put into the supply is evolving.
The president signed legislation back in July regarding opioids. Does that actually stop anything, or is that more just posturing?
I think that's a, which bill, I guess I should first ask, do you know?
Well, he signed a bill to restrict opioids coming into, fentanyl. He restricted fentanyl coming in, I think, from China, or any country for that matter. So he was trying to block fentanyl from getting here. Now, people have been signing legislation since the 60s on trying to stop stuff from getting here. And it gets here.
Yeah.
So, this is new legislation. It takes a while. As a matter of fact, I think, and I'm just speculating because that's not the arena of which I dwell in, but he can sign it, but it may take till 2026 for it to actually have an impact, because you have to get into the places where the fentanyl is coming in. You got to find out, where is it coming from? How is it getting here? And I think a lot, when it comes to illegal drugs, illegal guns, it's all speculation. Now, yeah, we have the FBI, we have the CIA, we have other organizations that deal with criminal background. But do they really know how to stop something that's at that level? Because fentanyl makes so much money, it allows you to cut, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but to cut the opioid so that you can make a lot more money off of it. So how do you really stop something that's making a lot of money?
It's a great question. And I think, you know, specific to any new bills, it's hard to really know what kind of impacts that's going to have. But what I can, you know, say is certainly controlling and trying to control the drugs that are coming into this country, it's a part of the puzzle. There's no question about that. So I don't want to diminish that, like, trying to prevent endless flows of fentanyl from getting in is a bad thing. But it's such so much more complex and nuanced than just stopping the drug. Because, you know, if people have a substance use disorder, they're going to try to find something to use. And, you know, we want to stop people from the demand from being there. You know, that's got to be just as much of, if not more, in my opinion, of a priority as preventing that demand through prevention, through providing people with the resources they need and preventing them from developing a dependence on a drug like fentanyl. You know, that being said, when it comes to, like, what you mentioned, drugs is big business. And I think if you look at technically the largest businesses in the world, the first one is human trafficking, that as a business, and that includes, like, child labor and, you know, obviously all sorts of trafficking and things like that. But beyond that, the second biggest is easily the drug business and the drug trade. And you're right.
Illegal.
Honestly, yeah, I don't. The drug trade too, though, even the legal one is a pretty big business, but I True. Know what you mean. And the reality is, though, fentanyl is, like you said, it's good business because it's very, very potent. It's actually short acting. So people oftentimes need to use 3, 4, 5, 6 times a day because it wears off quicker than older opioids. Like, you know, you think of heroin, that lasts longer. So people need it more. Like you said, it's so potent that a little bit can be mixed in with other drugs, and that can really stretch that from the business side, the dollar, but also too, just, it is small, like oftentimes powdered. And even if half of it gets confiscated crossing the border, the gains from just half, the other half making it across the border and entering the drug supply far outweighs any losses. So, yeah, I mean, you're talking about a complex issue. And, well, I think that's important. You know, I still always lean back on, like, what can we do to reduce the demand? Because the supply wouldn't be there if there wasn't a huge True. Demand for it.
Now, your title is opioid coordinator. but you handle substance abuse disorder or prevention of substance abuse disorder. So that covers more than just opioid, doesn't it?
Yeah, and I think, you know, the opioid coordinator title was probably most relevant even 5 years ago. That's really when fentanyl was peaking, especially COVID, and that was like the main threat. But I think we've just continued to see it evolve, and it just goes back into this is a synthetic drug supply problem, not just an opioid problem, you know. Obviously, opioids are still the leading cause of death from overdose, but stimulants use is on the rise. Trends are changing. Stimulants would be like cocaine, but methamphetamine we're seeing on the rise, and even synthetic stimulants. So, you know, I think overdose prevention is more, I guess, encompassing because it's evolving into really a bigger synthetic drug problem. If anything, it should be synthetic drug coordinator. You know what I mean? Like, that's not going to be the title, but I think that's really where that delineation comes from.
You know, I'm seeing, and this wouldn't be in your wheelhouse, I don't think, but I think that there's some comorbidity with or relationship with this. I'm seeing a lot of younger people taking Viagra or Cialis, and they're in their 20s and 30s. Taking something that you would think that males in their 50s and 60s would be taking. So if you're seeing them taking that type of thing, that's going to lead to a certain type of abuse. And where I'm going with this is you mentioned synthetic. Would you know if there's steroids falling in that category as well? Because a lot of young people, because they want to buff up or they want to fit in, so they're taking steroids so that they can look a certain way or have a certain energy level. Do you see that coming across your desk at some point?
It's hard for me to really speak on like some of those exact examples or steroids or even some of those medications that you referenced. But I think really at the end of the day, when we're talking synthetic drugs, it's those drugs made in a lab, the drugs that aren't, you know, naturally occurring. And obviously, you know, steroids could fall into that. That doesn't really fall in my wheelhouse, so can't speak to it too much. But, you know, it is, I think what you're speaking to, too, really just highlights that, like, our relationship sometimes with medications and with drugs is something that we need to look closer at.
Looking closer, because young people think everybody is old, and they're a little bit reluctant to listen to common sense. As a matter of fact, it's oftentimes said common sense isn't so common anymore. How do you handle young people making this a recreational activity?
Isn't that just the million-dollar question? But I think we have made strides in general. Just I think back to when I was in school, DARE was really popular, and maybe DARE was well-intentioned, but I don't think it had the intended outcome because oftentimes it turned into really demonizing and fear tactics that, you know, almost were like, just say no. Like, and if someone did make a mistake, you don't want to talk about it because it's so shameful. And, you know, also I think built some mistrust because, like, you would have thought from DARE that if you smoked weed, for instance, you'd be seeing stuff on the walls. And so when someone doesn't realizes, oh, I'm just hungry and, you know, giggling, like, this isn't what I thought it was, it kind of almost defeats the purpose of, like, the dangers of drugs because you're not going to see it immediately. So I think when we talk about working with youth now, it's how can you build resilience in youth? How can you prop up healthy outlets for youth? Make sure kids are getting involved with things that they're passionate about, because one of the greatest protective factors, in my opinion, is being connected to things you're passionate about and one that you want to excel in. Because if you have that purpose, to jeopardize that using drugs is less likely. But also, how can you incorporate peers? So younger people, either kids who have younger people who have struggled and can share their story and relate to the kids, or even just like programs that have people. Like I know in some of the counties I work with in Northwest Ohio, some of the smaller, more rural counties, they'll have like panels of high school kids who are working with junior high kids, and they've made this pledge to be drug free, but also to educate. And oftentimes, who do you think's the coolest when you're in seventh, eighth grade? You think that high school kid's the coolest. So if their influence can be leveraged to build prevention, that's very important. Unfortunately, a lot of the funding we get, and my grant, for instance, doesn't really focus on youth prevention, but I think that it is a critical part of the picture, because that's how we, like we're circling back to reducing demand. That's how you can catch kids early and, you know, teach them lessons that they can carry on. So
you mentioned your grant. You deal with more than just Lucas County. How big is your platform, your territory?
You know, we're serving as like a regional lead for this grant. It sounds almost fancier than it is, because we're just there to provide support. And so many of these counties are already doing such amazing work. It's been honestly really cool to see. And every community has different needs. So many people are doing very different things based on the readiness of a community or what is the risk of that community. But our region is like Northwest Ohio. So it's 19 counties in Northwest Ohio. And the grant really just focuses on, bringing down stigma, because that's a big one. Continuing to be able to allow people to feel safe opening up about these problems, but also really fitting the needs of how can we maybe help with funding, or how can we help with technical assistance as we can for certain areas. And, you know, that's really the focus of the grant. But it's been very interesting work, and it's been great to meet different people in the area doing the work.
You know, I remember way back when there was an old country song that had the lyrics in it, "Wildwood Weed Grows Wild on the Farm," and we never knew what it was called. We just knew the result of it. But now many counties or many towns, they wish that was their only concern, was wildwood weed growing wild on the farm, because there's so much more that young people are getting involved in. And when you get into the rural areas, man, it's easy to hide stuff. And I don't know how you guys would deal with it, because your department only has so much authority. But are you able to work with other departments? And as I'm saying that, you had your own demons that you had to fight with at one time. Does that give you any additional understanding of how to help somebody navigate and negotiate through dealing with exposure to substance abuse?
I think, you know, lived experience certainly is very, very helpful, especially in the sense of, while everyone's story can be very different and everyone's struggles, whether it's from a community or individual's perspective, can look so different. You know, at the end of the day, at the core, it's all similar. And I think just having that message of hope and of there being better days ahead, especially with the right support and the right connections and the right resources, you know, that's kind of the message that I try to carry on. And a lot of my role too has been working with public safety, and public safety plays a much bigger role in this issue than I think people realize. And even sometimes they realize, if you work for fire department now, you may encounter, especially like Toledo Fire, you may go on a couple overdose runs every single day, which is not why people typically sign up to be a firefighter. True. And oftentimes you're seeing the same person over and over again. So in this role, we've actually been able to implement some programming where they can leave behind kits to hopefully reduce their burden a little bit. And when I say kits, like Narcan or Naloxone kits to people they respond to. But also just reminding them that, like, in those encounters, a fire or EMS or that first responder isn't necessarily going to be the person that's going to hold someone's hand, take them to treatment, but having a positive interaction, especially after someone, regardless of if it's your first time overdosing or your 20th, that's a very low point in someone's life. If you can make that interaction positive in some way, or just listen, even if they maybe don't want to hear advice, you know, you never know the impact that could have. Maybe that person could wake up the next day and say, you know what? Wow, that interaction, like that first responder treated me like we've heard before. I can't remember the last time someone treated me like I was human. And hopefully that's not common, but maybe just a good interaction could lead someone to reaching out for help the next day, or, you know, reaching out to someone they trust and saying, like, I think I just want to give this a shot. And so a lot of this work and through my personal stuff, like, has been working with first responders and trying to break down any misconceptions or stigmas that could be making it harder to make a difference, but also reminding them that you're often the first one to interact with this vulnerable person, because, you know, the 911 is called, you show up and you're with them, and that could be a turning point for someone. So yeah, I don't know if that fully answers the question you're asking, but that's kind of a way I've weaved in my experiences. And that's including just like from a regional perspective, not just local, just trying to help other counties. Like if they, you know, we've done it in Toledo, like this Leave Behind program where they can leave a kit. We've built up policies and procedures through previous grants. And so like, even if it's just sharing those policies and procedures with another county and saying, hey, like, this is what we did, maybe it'll be helpful for you. It may not fit exactly what you need, but it's a starting point that can actually, you know, oftentimes in public health, the best ideas are recycled ideas. And so I think that's a big part of the work too.
All right, we're going to talk about the chalk walk, but oftentimes you'll hear about an opioid emergency or opioid alert. What constitutes that alert?
Yeah.
What triggers that?
There's different mechanisms that can trigger it. Like we get data from the health department from Toledo Fire. They'll send us like their overdose run reports so we can monitor if there's been a spike in the number of runs or the number of DOAs or people who were deceased on arrival. So we can get that data. We have a great partner at Toledo Fire that we can actually get that pretty quickly compared to, I think, other areas. But we also are plugged in with like a hospital system where we'll get a notification if there's been a spike in emergency room visits for an overdose. And then anecdotally you'll hear, so we just try to send out an alert if we do detect a spike, and we have currently set thresholds that probably need reassessed, because I don't think we've sent one really recently. But long story short, if from one of our data sources we see, oh, there's been a spike in either total overdoses in a 24-hour period or deaths, we try to get information out to the community just to say, and our partners mainly, like, within your network, share information with the people that you work with, because we've seen this spike. This is harm reduction messaging. This is how people can be safe. You know, be aware of, and kind of go from there.
What is that threshold?
Right now, it's 2 deaths in a 24-hour period in Lucas County, and like 10 total overdoses would trigger it. But like I said, I think it's can be so evolving, and I think it's more nuanced. Like, even if there's a huge drug bust, for instance, you know, that could be a time to share out messaging, maybe not an alert, but the same alert or the same messaging as an alert, because that could be a big disruption in the drug supply.
Create an urgency.
Yeah. And people who normally get their drug from one place, if there's a big bust, these people still are going to go into withdrawal and want to use. So they may go somewhere else they're not familiar, get something, a different drug from a different dealer. And that could actually pose a lot of risks. Like, a lot of times you'll see when there are those really big busts, from a law enforcement perspective, that like that can be when a lot of the community that is struggling with a substance use disorder can be most vulnerable. So, and another thing too is like, if there is a hot batch, which would be like term for a very potent drug, you know, sometimes people who are using want to seek that drug out because that means it's good.
So if it killed this person, I want it.
Yeah. And you know, that just highlights, I think, the disease. Like, it's logically, does it make sense logically in your right mind? No. But at the end of the day, you know, addiction, your brain is hijacked and you're not making logical decisions because, you know, you have literally become like, it's like a computer virus where the most important thing is not to be sick, to get that relief, to have that drug. And biologically it overtakes, you know, any
you're
reason
rational.
Or yeah. So
let's talk about the chalk walk.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's coming up. It's something that you've been doing at least 4 years, maybe longer. It's an event. Well, you talk about the characteristics of the event.
Yeah. So I think just to circle back to, in the light of all the work we do, we recognize that many, many people have lost their life and loved ones have lost family members and people that they're close to from an overdose. And it's really, Chalk the Walk is to remember those that have been lost to an overdose. So International Overdose Awareness Day, which is recognized by like DeWine in Ohio, many other communities do International Overdose Awareness Days, is August 31st of each year. typically that's when we hold our event, but this year we're going to be holding it on September 13th, which is a Saturday, from 3 to 7 at Promenade Park downtown. And like I said, it's for International Overdose Awareness Day, and it's truly meant to be a memorial in a way for families and for people impacting the community to come out and remember those that they've lost and remember them for who they were, not maybe what drugs have taken from them. And I think it's really beautiful. It can be an emotional day, but I think it's a powerful day. And in that light, we do not want it to be a resource fair because, you know, we want it to be about remembering and serving those and those that we've lost. But we do invite vendors. We just require that they bring an activity that is family friendly and aligns with that mission of the day. So like in the past, we've had people bring stuff that you could paint, like rocks. You could paint a rock for the memory of a loved one, or you could complete a painting, or you could do like we've had a lot of creative ones. I'm blanking out because there's so many creative ones, but you know, even just like messages of hope that you can write and put in a box, and then you know that'll be taken to a treatment center for people struggling to read, things like that. Usually we call it Chalk the Walk because usually chalk is a big part of the day. People can come and do art on the sidewalks. They can chalk the name of someone who's been lost. They can submit their names. And one of the great things about Promenade is it has that big screen downtown, so people can submit photos of their loved ones with a message. And so I think it's very powerful for people to submit that, to come. And we've, you know, like you've said, I don't know if we've done it 7 years now, or I don't know the exact number. Obviously, this will be my 4th year in this position doing it. And we feel honored to be able to host it and have the funding from, you know, our grants to be able to host it. But it really does serve as a great way to honor those we've lost and then hopefully build towards a future where less people will be lost. And it also really bleeds well into Recovery Month and that like message of hope, where September is Recovery Month. And, you know, I think it really serves as, yeah, like I said, a great event to bring people together first and foremost.
They can go to the website to find out more about it?
Yeah, so we're getting all that stuff up now. We have an official flyer, but that can be found at our Facebook page, actually, is probably the best spot. So the Lucas County Substance Use Response Coalition Facebook page.
Say that again.
Yeah, Lucas County Substance Use Response Coalition. And that Facebook page will have information about the event, ways that even potentially volunteer sign up, stuff like that. But, you know, it's free to attend. Chalk's provided. There will be naloxone training on site for folks. So if someone was interested in taking a naloxone kit, maybe has someone that they know that's struggling or just want to carry it because they want to, who knows, if you encounter someone in the community, you know, it really should be like an extension of your first aid kit. They could get trained and take a kit home with them.
And those are free kits.
Yep, yep. And that will be, we'll do trainings there. There will be a reading of the names at 6:30 so people can submit the name of a loved one and then those names will be read. And that's really towards the tail end of the event. Like I said, it's 3 to 7. But, you know, that's, and even chalk, those things will be available. So you don't need to bring your own if you don't want to, but you're more than welcome to. So, yeah. And we just encourage people to come out and, you know, experience the day. And even if it's just to learn a little bit more, we always think that that's a great thing. So,
all right, Tony, thank you for coming in and talking to us and sharing everything that has to do with substance abuse prevention. Yeah, you're the opioid coordinator, but you cover a huge umbrella of other activities that really help save lives. I want to thank Tony for coming in and sharing the information with us. I'm your host and producer, Jerome Graham. Our executive producer is Mr. Chris Piper. If you have any questions, comments, or you just want to listen again, go to WGTE.org/hope or wherever you stream your podcast.
WGTE. Voices around us.